content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading selections from Our State Magazine. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. In this episode, we'll dig a little deeper into the April issue of Our State Magazine, the theme of which features articles all about North Carolina's revolutionary heritage. The article is entitled, On the Path to Freedom. A historian traveled thousands of miles around our state on a quest to compile stories of the American Revolution. In North Carolina, that history lives all around us, even if we can't see it. As manager of the circa 1760 Bradford Denton House and assistant site manager at Historic Halifax, respectively, Jeff Dickens and Frank McMahon share the revolutionary history of this town on the Roanoke River. And the picture is of a very plain colonial house. The two gentlemen are dressed in revolutionary garb and holding a flag on the front porch on this well-manicured lawn. We were enjoying a walk in the woods on a soft summer day, following no trail. The Cape Fear River lazing to our left as a stream-cut ravine deepened to the right. I'd quickly become best buddies with Scott McCoy, the facility supervisor who arranged my visit to this Fayetteville Public Works Commission land that's off limits to the public. We sought a historical artifact but found only a rare view of the river where Rockfish Creek feeds in. Retracing our steps, we swung around a hairpin curve of the creek to the area where a colonial road would have crossed it in February of 1776. 250 years ago, some 1,600 Loyalists, or Tories, supporters of King George III, followed that colonial road from Cross Creek, now Fayetteville, toward Wilmington. They were answering a call from Royal Governor Josiah Martin to help a British army retake control of North Carolina. Martin had come down the same road the previous June when rebels we call Patriots or Whigs had scared him into fleeing New Bern for Fort Johnston at today's Southport. A month later, as Martin watched from a British gunboat, 500 Patriots burned the fort in the first military action of the American Revolution in North Carolina, the only colonial or British fort destroyed by rebels anywhere during the war. To block the Tories, Colonel James Moore and 1,000 soldiers had camped where Scott and I were standing and built a breastwork. A 1904 book said it still existed. We headed west, pushing through underbrush and stepping over logs. I was getting more sweat and scratches than satisfaction. Finally, I announced, "We're just going to head straight back this way to the truck, and if we don't find it, so be it." 2 minutes later, I practically tripped over a low linear mound about 5 feet wide at the base, the best preserved Revolutionary era earthwork I've seen in the state. I can say that because what started as a hobby 5 years ago turned into an obsession when I realized there was no detailed guide to Revolutionary War sites in North Carolina. As a lifelong history buff raised here with a master's degree in journalism, I decided to fix that. The resulting book-length website, mrevnc.com, tells the stories of more than 100 locations like the site of this breastwork. I'll repeat that website again for you, amrevnc.com, mrevnc.com. It did its job, forcing back the Loyalists, but they crossed the river and eventually made their way to a huge defeat at the Battle of Moore's Creek Bridge. In time, this forced some 3,000 British soldiers floating on the Cape Fear to go elsewhere, after an ineffective raid on the old colonial capital by a man destined to gain infamy in the new state, Lieutenant General Lord Charles Cornwallis. The bared foundations of that capital, Brunswick Town, illustrate how much history is barely seen in North Carolina, perhaps because so much research is required. 1 year, I drove 8,000 miles around the state to libraries, archives, historic sites, hills, woods, homes, graves, streams, and towns. The evidence I uncovered led me down and up astonishing paths. A month after the adoption of the Halifax Resolves, more blows were struck for freedom, this time from the perspective of the Cherokee. Tired of colonist violations of their treaty border with Britain, a faction raided settlements on the frontier, killing around 40 people. In response, Brigadier General Griffith Rutherford led about 2,400 militia as far west as modern Murphy, destroying 11 farming towns and their crops with winter approaching. Three of my ancestors were in that army. Picnicking near purple butterflies on one of those flattened farms near ancient Cowie Mound created a mixed emotion I couldn't label. Headed that way on U.S. Route 23/441 over Cowie-Watauga Gap, a left leads to a dead end on the former highway, which follows the colonial path. Standing where the Kudzu has taken the road over and looking west, that's what Private Billy Alexander saw minutes before 20 warriors rose at the gap, fired a volley, and gave him a limp for life. Over the next few years, North Carolina men mostly went to war elsewhere in the, quote, United Colonies, including 400 people of color who brought along some of their families. Women who were left behind took over family farms and businesses, dealing with shortages of everything and sometimes standing up to armed bullies. Paper promises printed by the state as money for lack of metal coins rapidly became worthless. Salt riots broke out. The state created a tiny navy to keep some goods flowing through a British blockade, though legal pirates called privateers were more effective. Loyalist families were hardest hit as the state passed laws to take their lands. World-famous Flora MacDonald was constantly harassed by patriots at her plantation in the Uwharries, south of Troy. Her husband had been captured at Moore's Creek, and Tory neighbors blamed her for their suffering because he had recruited their sons and husbands. On our third try to find the MacDonald home site, AMREV's NC site investigator, Martin Brown, and I drove down a road that turned to gravel and parked by Cheeks Creek. We walked a thin trail across open woods, then plunged through gravy bushes down to the water. After searching in both directions, we found ourselves standing on a half-buried timber that we believed to be part of the McDonald's mill building. Loyalists seeking freedom from the state government in the region east of Tarboro used symbolic sticks and secret words in their plot to kidnap the governor. The Gourd Patch plot fell apart through an attack of conscience. Many people just wanted the freedom to avoid the war. Religious groups that opposed the conflict, like the Moravians, were harassed by both sides, including many incidents in today's Old Salem. These groups ended up paying three times the taxes of everyone else to avoid military service. Some evidence suggests that frontiersman Daniel Boone may have been neutral about the Revolutionary War, yet he joined the militia in 1775. I fulfilled a 50-year dream on my second run to a rural road southwest of Wilkesboro, armed with an archaeology report provided by one of our state's invaluable county history librarians. I looked through an arch of greenery into a farm field speckled with flowers at the only Boone home site in North Carolina visible to the public. In my head appeared the cover of a book I'd read at age 11, showing a young Daniel Boone rafting the Yadkins. One of my life's circles closed. When Charleston fell to the British in May of 1780, North Carolina's regular Continental Army troops and many militia disappeared into prison camps, where some 800 died. Brigadier General James Hogan was one of them, choosing to stay with his men and paying with his life. Staring at the site of the home he hoped to return to, outside Hobgood, now a tobacco field in Halifax County, I contemplated his example of true leadership. More troops were lost when Major General Horatio Gates unwisely marched into South Carolina and blundered into an army led by Cornwallis. Gates rode a 180-mile arc through North Carolina in 3 days to escape, forgetting to bring his army, and earning a snarky comment from Alexander Hamilton. Cornwallis invaded North Carolina that fall. One afternoon, the skyscrapers of uptown Charlotte disappeared in my mind's eye as I saw from afar a green dot appear down Tryon Street. As I watched, that green soon expanded into the green-coated cavalry of the British Legion, minus its ill and infamous commander, Lieutenant Colonel Banastre Tarleton. The dragoons charged past me toward the wooden courthouse in the middle of the intersection with Trade Street. They were thrice turned back by volleys from under and around it as 200 patriots faced down Cornwallis's men. The redcoat infantry drove them off, but they had bought time for another militia to escape. Cornwallis occupied the town and sent a force west to suppress the patriots. Its commander, Major Patrick Ferguson, camped outside Rutherfordton. Its commander, Major Patrick Ferguson, had camped outside Rutherfordton, made the mistake of threatening to cross the Appalachians into modern Tennessee to, quote, lay waste with fire and sword. The so-called overmounted men and other militia came after him, catching up at King's Mountain. They killed or captured most of Ferguson's men and two of his mistresses, leaving him in the rock-covered grave where he still lies. Cornwallis withdrew south. For 6 months in late 1780 and early 1781, North Carolina was the center of the Revolutionary War. When another chunk of his army was captured and hauled this way, Cornwallis gave chase, pushing across the Catawba where Lake Norman Dam is now. Prescient planning by the Continental Major General Nathaniel Greene got his men across the Yadkin at the Trading Ford near Spencer and blocked the British. He received a warm meal and much-needed cash for the army from tavern owner Elizabeth Steele in Salisbury and left his mark on a portrait of King George III, still visible at Thyatira Presbyterian Church. Greene's army finally slipped across the Dan River in Virginia minutes ahead of the British, winning the, quote, race to the Dan. This strategic withdrawal through the state is still taught in military schools. After gathering troops and supplies, Greene returned to force a battle. Meanwhile, Cornwallis took over Hillsborough and called for loyalists to join him. In Burlington, a residential street peters out partway into a yard. I asked an older gentleman, did you know you're mowing a battlefield? He didn't. Tories under Colonel John Pyle, heeding Cornwallis's call, stepped aside to let a green-coated cavalry ride by, discovering far too late that these were the men of Continental Lieutenant Colonel Henry Lee. One quarter were killed in Pyle's defeat or massacre. I told the mower that bodies once lay at our feet. After more maneuvering and several minor battles, the armies met on Greene's chosen ground at Guilford Courthouse in modern Greensboro. The British held the field at the end of the day, but lost a fourth of their troops. Cornwallis's forces retreated downstate and never recovered. Their next major battle at Yorktown would be their last. On the way, they paused in Wilmington, occupied by a British corps for most of 1781. Today, you can walk the likely campsite just south of downtown. Major James Craig raided as far north as Newbern, where I stood by a marina and watched as a Tory officer shot a patriot escaping by rowboat, the victim's wife standing by me. A former grief support volunteer, I thought of the complications raised when you had no control over the fate of your spouse. And to clarify that, when he stood by the marina, he, quote, watched as a Tory officer shot a patriot escaping by rowboat. Apologize. Not surprisingly, the British ranks were swelled by more people seeking their own definition of freedom. Suffering some of the worst slavery conditions in the civilized world, hundreds of African Americans escaped their patriot enslavers, despite militia orders saying they could be killed merely for carrying provisions of any kind. Even after the British left, the civil war between Whigs and Tories in North Carolina was the bloodiest of any states. Among other exploits, Loyalist Colonel David Fanning, based near Ramsur, captured Governor Thomas Burke and much of the government in Hillsborough. On a treeless hill near what is now the Asheboro Airport, Fanning shot a Patriot officer in the man's home in front of his 10-year-old daughter. Standing at the home site brought me chills on a warm day, but Whigs were quick with the extra-legal rope, hanging many loyalists without trial from the Tory Oak in what is now Wilkesboro. Eventually, the Tories were defeated in eastern North Carolina. At Elizabethtown, a female spy helped some 70 patriots send 300 down the, quote, Tory hole, and a surprise charge into Little Raft Swamp near Red Springs drove loyalists off their Scotch ponies for good. A supply raid on Beaufort the next year featured the last engagement with redcoats in North Carolina. The British commander-in-chief said their fall in America was the result of a chain of evils, starting with Kings Mountain, most of whose links lay in North Carolina. This anniversary year, you can explore the entire state by walking in the footsteps of different kinds of freedom seekers, not soldiers fighting distant battles in faraway lands, but everyday people, perhaps our own ancestors, whose tears and blood soaked into our state's soil, whose stories we can discover in our own backyard. Again, the website for Jim Morgan is amrevnc.com. That's A-M like Michael, R-E-V like Victory, N-C.com. Our next article is entitled, Where the Halifax Resolved Took Shape. Hidden since 1849, the footprint of the colonial courthouse that helped spark America's independence has finally been located. When the multicolored image loaded onto his computer screen, Jordan Cole tried to temper his excitement. The deep blue area was the right shape, the right size, and in the right location, but he couldn't have found the outline of the 1760s Halifax courthouse so quickly. It's never that easy. He stared at the image for a couple of minutes, and his certainty solidified. He turned to his colleague and said, I think you should look at this. The North Carolina Office of State Archaeology had contracted New South Associates, where Cole works as a geophysical specialist, to find the location of Halifax's original courthouse in 2022, after previous attempts to locate it had been unsuccessful. When a new courthouse was built in 1849, the old building was demolished so completely that for generations, no obvious evidence of it remained. The original courthouse holds historical significance to the state and to the country as a whole because on April 12, 1776, the Fourth Provincial Congress adopted the Halifax Resolves here, the first official action by any colony calling for independence from Britain. Later, the first public reading in North Carolina of the Declaration of Independence happened in front of the building, and the state's first constitution was drafted here as well. The 83 delegates present on April 12th unanimously adopted the resolves, which directed recommendations for independence to the Continental Congress. At the meeting in Philadelphia a month later, Joseph Hughes, one of North Carolina's delegates, presented the Halifax resolves to the Continental Congress. Hughes became one of North Carolina's signers of the Declaration of Independence, along with William Hooper and John Penn. We'll never know for certain, but it's possible that without the Halifax Resolves, we wouldn't be celebrating the country's semi-quincentennial this year. Excuse me. This April, Halifax will commemorate the 250th anniversary of the drafting of the Resolves with speakers, reenactments, a concert, and a wreath-laying ceremony. Much of the programming will take place near the site of the original courthouse, which is now outlined in brick and filled in with gravel. One of the reasons we wanted to find the courthouse is because people are always asking for something tangible that's connected to the Halifax Resolve, says Frank McMahon, assistant site manager at Historic Halifax. To find the courthouse is a direct connection. People have been looking for the courthouse since the 1960s when archaeologist Stanley South did an excavation here. South used a 1769 map by French cartographer Claude Sautier to locate his dig site. Sautier created several maps of notable North Carolina colonial towns, and his maps were scarily accurate, says Samantha Taylor, a former New South Associates senior archaeologist. But South misinterpreted the map, mistaking an existing 1836 jail for the original demolished jail that Sautier had plotted. So, though he dug directly on the courthouse site, he didn't realize what he had found. In the 1970s, archaeologist Stuart Swartz briefly looked for the courthouse site, but concluded that due to soil erosion, all evidence of the footprint had likely been lost. In 2018, David Cranford joined the Office of State Archaeology and was tasked with finding ways to engage the public. So he set up a public dig site at Halifax and coordinated with ECU graduate student Matt Harrop to perform a survey using ground-penetrating radar, or GPR, a method that uses radio pulse waves to create an image of the subsurface. The technology was first used in archaeology in the 1970s, but had only recently begun to be commonly used in archaeological studies. Harrop's results were mixed. Cranford's team uncovered some artifacts, ceramics, pipe stems, a gunflint, but nothing that would determine the courthouse location. They didn't even know if they were looking in the right area. Then, in 2022, the Office of State Archaeology approached McMahon and historic Halifax site manager Carl Burke with a proposal to engage an archaeological firm to survey the site using GPR again. This time, Burke and McMahon knew exactly where to look. Using the 1769 Sautier map and a tape measure, the pair determined what they thought to be the correct location. Cole brought the GPR machine, wheeled it meticulously back and forth over the designated spot in straight parallel lines, and they found it, McMahon says. The GPR image of the site shows a dark blue T-shape surrounded by areas of lighter blue, yellow, red, and green. The dark blue is a negative. It shows the area that was protected from traffic while the courthouse was in place, where the soil is less compressed. The brighter colors around the T-shape depict soil compaction from pedestrians and horses during the time that the building was in use. When Cole saw the crystal clear image, he couldn't believe it. Usually when we're looking for buildings, especially this old, reflections can be quite difficult to discern, he says, but this was really quite spectacular. As soon as we were able to put all the profiles together and produce a 3D image, it was immediately obvious that we had found the courthouse just like that, he said, snapping his fingers. After 6 decades of unsuccessful attempts, Cranford, Burke, and McMahon couldn't believe it either. It really blew my mind, Cranford says. For Burke, it was a sense of confirmation. And after studying it and looking at it and thinking about it and coming out here and measuring and thinking that it ought to be right about here, it was just very redeeming, he says. It was just one of those moments of completeness. Today you can stand in the very spot where the Halifax Resolves was most likely drafted, imagining what it would have been like when 83 delegates crowded into the small building to adopt the resolution. You can tour the 18th century buildings such as the Eagle Tavern and the Tap Room, which open a window onto Revolutionary War life. You can walk the very ground where the Declaration of Independence was first read aloud in North Carolina, picturing the day revolutionary leader Cornelius Harnett unrolled the document in front of the courthouse to a jubilant yet reverent crowd. You can almost hear the shouts of joy when he finished. Even though the building is not there anymore because it's been auctioned off, go to visit that actual location where these things took place is powerful, McMahon says. But without the visible outline of the courthouse that's on the site now, visitors wouldn't know the significance of this place. They wouldn't know when they're standing in the footsteps of our forefathers, the founding fathers of our country. I think finding the courthouse and celebrating it and sharing that narrative with the public instills a lot of pride in one's country and pride in one's state, Taylor says. It's a very important symbol to remind people that North Carolina was part It was very important, symbol to remind people that North Carolina was part of this early movement to secede and rebel. It emphasizes that North Carolina has this often untold or unforgotten significance to that narrative of freedom. And here is where it all began. Okay, to round out our episode, we'll look at one of the regular columns called Our State Supper Club. Gather around the table for meals and memories. This one is entitled The Lunch Line. A full tray, an ice-cold sweet tea, and a midday break brings us back to our cafeteria days. Halfway through the Sunday sermon, I'd start thinking about my lunch order at the cafeteria. As everyone bowed their heads, I prayed that the preacher wouldn't talk too long as we shook his hand to leave. Thankfully, Irving Park United Methodist Church wasn't that far from the closest K&W cafeteria, a staple at Greensboro's Friendly Center since 1965. My sisters and I would race to the heavy glass doors, but knew not to run in our Mary Janes once they hit the tile floor. The view from our place in line was of men in their Sunday suits, women wearing church dresses and matching pumps, and children desperately trying to behave. Once jeweled hairnets were in sight, my senses came alive. The wall of hot steam warmed my face. The scent of salty, overcooked green beans drew me in for a closer look, and the sounds of the ladies' voices asking, "Serve you meat? Tartar or slaw? Bread? Dessert?" made my anticipation swell. My dad ordered the 8-ounce with, which was a chopped steak au jus with a dill pickle on top. Mom and I would get the fried fish with tartar sauce loaded with chopped onion, while my sisters enjoyed baked spaghetti or fried chicken with blue jello. For dessert, I'd reach for the largest piece of egg custard pie, from which I'd only eat the custard. At the end of the line, the glasses of ice water, unsweetened tea with lemon, and sweet tea stood lined up in perfect order. The day I learned K&W was closing in December after 88 years of service, I thought of the employees who'd worked in the kitchen for more than 3 decades. When I recreate my favorites from the cafeteria line, I think of those ladies who served my family and me. I hope they know what a legacy they leave behind for all the Southern cooks who longed for lunch at the cafeteria on Sundays after church. I'll finish this up here with a little bit from the quiz. This is called Course Correct. Along Old North State's coast, pirate lore lingers. And I'll read the first question. The most famous earliest 18th century pirate to operate off North Carolina's coast, Blackbeard spent years in the Caribbean before heading to the Carolinas around 1718. By what other name was he known? Was it Edward Teach, Edward Elgar, or Edward Smith? If you guessed Edward Teach, you would be correct. Well, that sound means that our time is up. And we, for our episode of Our State Magazine, we hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll join us next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Our State Magazine is also available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. For any questions or comments, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. Again, that's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.